compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. Thanks again, as ever, for listening to the Patrick Madrid Show. I promised you I would share with you a letter that some nurse students received. These are students in Ireland. And Cyrus, it's from the, what is it again? It's the name of the school where they're taking these courses.
Oh, it's referring to all the schools.
Throughout the country.
Right.
But the HSE, that's the...
Oh, boy.
You had told me that earlier today.
I had told you, and yeah. Now out of sight, out of mind.
I can
find it.
We'll find it. Okay, so I'll read the letter, and then at the end you can do it. So these are student nurses in Ireland who are, for whatever reason, they're just not into accepting the COVID-19 vaccine. And, you know, in the last couple of months since it's been rolled out big time, we've seen any number of stories of people who have had severe side effects, people who have died. And I'm not saying this to scare you away from getting the vaccine. Don't misunderstand what I'm saying. Don't write Father Rocky a letter saying Patrick Madrid said we shouldn't get. I'm not saying that. Okay. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that the news has been reporting about things like that. People having severe side effects. Some people even dying. It is what it is. Make of it what you will. All I'm doing is reporting this to you. So in Ireland, this letter was sent out from Dr. Colm Henry, the chief clinical officer of the HSE facilities.
That's Health Service Executive.
Health Service Executive, thank you. So this, as we understand it, Cyrus, correct me if I'm wrong, this governs the medical training of nurses and maybe doctors too, for that matter, throughout the...
Well, the HSE is responsible for the provision of health and personal social services for everyone living in Ireland.
Okay, so not just the medical people.
Right, and so I think this letter is specifically talking to any medical student, and they're not going to let them work.
Right. Well, don't steal my thunder.
All right.
Well, it is April Fool's, so let's see. So the heading is, this is dated the 26th of March, 2021, so just within the last week, and it's regarding students who decline vaccinations. Dear colleagues, last year, following engagement with your institutes, we were able to agree a process that facilitated essential clinical placements for healthcare students in HSC facilities through the past year. The process agreed was consistent with the need to ensure patient and student safety to the greatest degree practical at that time. We are all agreed that the safety of patients, staff, and students remains a shared key priority. I wish to advise you of some updated decisions in relation to clinical placements in the context of the COVID-19 vaccination program, which provided and added an opportunity to ensure the safety of all concerned. For this purpose, clinical placements refers to unpaid clinical, and that's underlined, unpaid clinical experience for healthcare students whose presence is not specifically required to sustain service delivery. Students, for example, fourth-year nursing students, who constitute part of the workforce that sustains service delivery, are in the same category as other healthcare workers. The following does not apply to them. Following considerations, the HSC COVID-19 Vaccination Working Group has taken the following decision, and I ask that your institutes now apply this to all student placements in HSC facilities with effect from April 1st, 2021. Students that are eligible for vaccination, that have been offered vaccination, and decline vaccination should not be assigned to clinical placements in HSC facilities. This may be reviewed as the epidemiological situation evolves. Please note that for those very exceptional circumstances where there is specific and documented medical contraindication to vaccination for a healthcare student, an individual risk assessment should be performed by the Higher Education Institute to determine if a suitable replacement can be designed that minimizes risks to patients and to the student. Kind regards, etc. So it's a very, you know, pleasantly worded statement saying basically you don't have the option. If you're going to work in this environment, you must accept the COVID-19 vaccine. Now, in that instance, of course, the health service has the right, the authority, I guess, to mandate its protocols. I don't quibble with that. But I'm just wondering about, what about somebody who says, you know, what about one of the nurses who says, I'm pregnant, or I'm newly married and I'm likely to get pregnant. And the pharmaceuticals have said, you know, that's a category of people who probably shouldn't get the vaccine. What about somebody who has some other reasonable reason for saying, I don't want to get it, or I'm concerned about the side effects? In this instance, it appears to me, and again, this is Ireland, it's not here, or maybe I should say it's not here yet, could get here, but it's an example of where this vaccine, and I suppose that sets the stage for others, could easily become mandatory, and there will not be the provision available to opt out. So I'm bringing that to your attention because, as you know, we talk about the vaccine with frequency on this program. I'm trying to keep you up to date as best I can on the things that are developing on this topic. And, of course, those students who maybe have invested 2, 3, 4 years of their lives in striving for this degree, for this diploma, they may, if they insist upon not getting the COVID-19 vaccine, they may have to look elsewhere for education or for a job. It's kind of getting to that point in some instances. 888-914-9149. Cyrus, were you going to say something? I didn't want to cut you off if you were.
Nope. You covered
okay.
it.
Okay, good. Liz in New Jersey, welcome to the program.
Hi. I was just calling because I just tuned in probably before the news came on, and you were speaking with someone about what profiteth a man if he lose his if he gains the whole world but loses his soul, mm-hmm. and then you were codifying that statement with, don't be writing in and don't put to Father Rocky or whatever. It just kind of upset me, and I kind of
why would it upset you?
Me that no. This is what I'm going to get to.
Okay.
You shouldn't have to do that because you're an apologist. You know the faith very well. And why should even Father Rocky, who's doing a wonderful job with Relevant Radio in, putting the truth out there of the Gospels, and you have to defend yourself or ward off the hate mongers. And it just annoys me because that is just showing the results of the times, and it's so wrong that you can't
Thank you.
Say what you feel you have to say and speak the truth. You have to do that. Do you know what I mean?
I do. At first, I didn't realize what you were referring to. I thought it was more on the negative side, but I see exactly what you're saying. Let me give you, from my perspective, a little insight into the situation. There are some people out there who are hair trigger and they get very angry by what they hear on this program. Not always because of what they actually heard, but because of what they think they heard or what they insinuated on the basis of what I said, maybe leaping to wrong conclusions or something. But the reason I said that, kind of tongue-in-cheek, but also kind of not tongue-in-cheek, is because, as Cyrus will attest, we'll get emails from somebody who said, Patrick was telling people not to get vaccines, and that's outrageous, and you need to... And I never said that, or I never said anything like that. And it's happened often enough that I was adding that little proviso in there just, for the sake of effect. But there really are people out there, Liz, who really do. I don't know if they're like waiting or something, but they get really angry. And they write really angry letters, and they, they're just incensed. So, Father Rocky's busy. He's got a ton of stuff to do. He reads all the emails. I don't mean to suggest he doesn't, and your reactions are important to us. But sometimes people's reactions are so out of proportion and so inaccurate in some ways that it's unfortunate that, they feel the need to do that. And that's why I was making that comment. But I do see your point, Liz.
Oh. I understand why you were making the, just that when I heard that, I thought to myself, what it's annoying and it's sad because mm-hmm. don't really listen. They want to hear what they want to hear. My son's always telling me, Mom, listen to me. So that's the thing. They don't listen, and you're right. They want to hear what they want to hear, not what you're actually saying.
That's true, Liz, and I appreciate that. It's also true that sometimes they do hear what I say and they're just so angered by it that they want to punish me, you know, and
Yeah.
You know, I would think people have more and better things to do with their time. But in any case, that's just, it goes with the territory, as the saying goes. It's part of the job and I'm used to it. And, but I appreciate the fact that you are picking up on something like that, like, you know, gee whiz, guys, it doesn't have to be that way. You don't have to do that. Mm-hmm. So I hear what you're saying, Liz. I do.
So that's all. And, you know, I do appreciate your program and I do get to listen to it because I, you know, I get to listen to it at least once a week, full through, or at least 2 hours of it when I'm at home and driving into work. So, and
Well, thank you.
Really enjoy your program very much. And you do
speak
the truth. And, That's the only reason I called in is, and I was annoyed. So I picked up the phone and I had to call.
Hey, Liz, I'll make a prediction. Somebody will write in an angry email that Liz was complaining about people who write angry emails.
You're probably right.
Well, maybe not.
Thanks,
Liz.
You never know. Father. Thanks, Patrick.
Thank you, Liz. I appreciate it. Yeah, I'm a dad, but I'm not a priest, that's for sure. Thank you. I appreciate it. 888-914-9149. Let's go over to Michigan now and talk to Jeff. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning. How are you?
I am well, thanks.
Hey, I was wondering, so if life started a garden, how come the church doesn't promote gardening or composting? I've never seen a garden at a church. I was in catechism and I went to church camp. We never gardened. We never composted.
You're not serious, Jeff, are you?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So you're seriously asking me why the Catholic Church doesn't promote gardening because Adam and Eve were in the garden?
Yeah.
Why should it?
Because that's what God intended, was for us to live in the garden.
Right. But you know how the story goes, right? You know that Adam and Eve were thrown out because of their sin?
Yeah, I know that.
Okay. And do you know what God told Adam that he would have to do? Genesis chapter 3. Remember that part where he told him, from now on, you have to, you know, work for your food and you have to deal with nature and such? So the garden that they were in before is no longer there. There's no way for you to create a Garden of Eden. And if you dug in your backyard and planted bulbs and flowers and things, that wouldn't amount to anything as far as the Garden of Eden is concerned. I don't see the connection.
No. But, I mean, okay, well, I guess. I guess if you don't see the connection, then we got nothing to talk about.
Okay, fair enough, Jeff. Thanks for calling. Let's go to Jean now in Minnesota. Hi, Jean.
Hi, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
The reason I'm calling is yesterday I was flipping through the TV and came across one of your talks that you were giving. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I came in towards the end of it and you were just finishing up about talking about a priest who, during his homily, had talked about being in a state of grace and, you know, when you should be going to communion and when you shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. And you said that by the time it came time to go to communion, a lot of people did not go to communion that day.
Oh, I remember that story.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just trying to find out what he said that caused that many people not to go to communion.
Okay. I probably have enough time to tell you that story, Gene, but I'll need to start it from the beginning so you understand the context. Is that what you'd like me to do?
Okay. I would love it. Thank you.
Okay, here goes. Okay. Well, those talks are all available on YouTube. So, okay. So here goes, Gene. I'll tell you the talk in context. I'll tell you the story in context. I was invited to speak. This is years ago, maybe 20 years ago. I was invited to speak at a parish in California. By this time, I was already living in Ohio, where I live now. But I was invited to speak at a conference, a Saturday conference at a parish in California that, oddly enough, was rather well known as being very left of center, as being a parish that was always sort of pushing the envelope in the direction of, you know, wanting women priests and wanting, you know, doing things that were contrary to what the church taught. And so I thought, why am I, of all people, being invited to speak at this parish? I couldn't imagine. And I discovered it was because the parish, because it was quite a large, beautiful parish that could seat maybe 2,000 people, it was rented for the day, for Saturday, by an organization that was bringing in a couple of speakers, myself and this Catholic priest whom I had never met. And so I figured, okay, that's why they're bringing us in. So I did the talk. I did several talks. And the way it would work is the priest who spoke before me, he was speaking very powerfully, and I would have to get up after he spoke and give my talk. It was not a position I relished, because his oratory was so powerful that I always felt like, you know, here comes the second string. But anyway, so he would speak, then I would speak, then he would speak, then I would speak, then we'd take a break, come back, do it in the afternoon. And by about 5 o'clock, everybody goes home. So all the 2,000 people who were there, they get in their minivans with their pro-life bumper stickers and the rosaries hanging from their back windows, and they pack up the strollers and the kids, and they all leave. And it dawned on me at that point that these are people who weren't from that parish. They came from points distant to attend this conference. So they all left. Well, about a half an hour later, 5:30 p.m. vigil mass starts, and that's the mass I had to go to because I was going to be on an airplane the following day going home. So I'm seeing all the cars coming in for the 5:30 mass, and I sat in the very back of the church. So I was even behind the pews in a chair against the back wall, and I had a commanding view of the entire church. It was one of these churches that kind of slopes down theater style to the center where the altar is, to the sanctuary. And I was surprised to see that the priest who had been speaking at this conference, he was going to be celebrating Mass. So he was helping out. That might have been part of the deal. If your priest will celebrate Mass, you know, give Father McGillicuddy an evening off, we'll rent the place to you as part of it. So anyway, so he comes in and he's the one who's going to celebrate Mass. And a lot of the people who were in the congregation, they were the typical, you know, kind of laid-back California Catholics. It looks like they just stopped barbecuing, and they were in flip-flops and T-shirts, and they just came in to go to Mass, and then they'd go back to the barbecue. So it was a rather casual-looking group, and my impression was they probably were not used to the kind of preaching and teaching that I had heard this priest give. So Mass continues, and then at the Gospel, the reading is from John chapter 6, the Bread of Life discourse. And so then everybody sits down, and the priest proceeds to preach. He proceeds to tell, you know, give his sermon. And he starts off much more mildly than I saw him do so in the talks that I saw that day. So he starts off by saying, you know, Jesus is your friend. Jesus loves you. The Holy Eucharist is food for the journey. And lots of very kind of warm and fuzzy, almost platitudes. And he seemed to be sort of anesthetizing the congregation, because everybody was sort of lulled into this very soft, fuzzy, you know, happy thoughts kind of thing. So he did that for a couple of minutes. And then he turned a corner when he said, and in this world, there are only two kinds of people, winners and losers. Now, at this point, these 2,000 laid-back California Catholics, they sort of sat up like, what? What did he just say? He said, in this life, there are only two kinds of people, winners and losers. Winners, he said, go to heaven, and losers, he said, go to hell. And he said, and most of you are probably losers. Now, at that point, Gene, there was an audible gasp. 2,000 people, what? What did he just say? You could have heard a pin drop. And I was thinking, whoa. Whoa, these people were not prepared for what was coming down the pike. So here's what happened, Gene. The next thing he said was so mind-blowing that I've never forgotten it, and I will tell you exactly what he said when we come back from this quick timeout. You don't want to miss this. What he said and how the 2,000 people, these laid-back California Catholics who had no preparation for what he was about to tell them, wait till you hear this. I'll tell you it when I come back from this quick time out. This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and RelevantRadio.com.
Okay, Gene in Minnesota, are you ready for the rest of the story?
I am ready.
Okay, good. So for those just tuning in, Gene had heard an anecdote, a talk that I gave that she saw. She heard me give a talk about a priest who said something dramatic to a congregation of people, and she came in at the tail end. She didn't hear exactly what happened, so I'm telling the story. So this powerful, you know, traditional kind of priest who just tore it up completely in a good sense at the conference that day. He's celebrating Mass as the visiting priest for a whole parish full of laid-back California Catholics who probably had never in their life heard anything dramatic or challenging to them in their lives. So here he is. He's preaching from the Gospel of St. John, chapter 6, the Bread of Life Discourse. He starts off by saying that Jesus is your friend and he loves you and the Eucharist is the food for the journey, and everybody was feeling very warm and fuzzy. And I was watching this from the back of the church where I was seated. And then he said, he turned a corner when he said, and in this life, there are only two kinds of people, winners and losers. And everybody sat up like, oh, what? What's he saying? And then he said, there are only two kinds of people, winners who go to heaven and losers who go to hell. And most of you are probably losers. So there was this collective gasp, and everybody was like, what? And amazingly, nobody got up and walked out. I was waiting for that, but you could have heard a pin drop. Everybody was just holding their breath like, what is he saying here? So then he went on and he said, here's why I say this. He said, because many of you, maybe most of you, adults, he said, are falling into serious sins, mortal sins on a regular basis. And then he went through a list of about, you know, 10 or 12 very common, very, very common mortal sins: internet pornography, drunkenness, infidelity, theft, you know, stealing from your employer because when you should be working and you're earning money, you're actually shopping on Amazon or you're checking out your Facebook page, and that's a form of theft. And he just went through this list of things: contraception, etc., divorced and civilly remarried, etc. So he went down this list and he says, most of you, I know this because I hear confessions every week and I hear confessions of people all over the country, and this is what's going on. So he said, most of you are probably committing all these serious sins. And he said, all of you are going to come up and go to Holy Communion. He says, this is a terrible phenomenon of Catholics who routinely fall into serious sin, or they just, you know, live there. They never really get out of it. They never really struggle against it. They're just perpetually living lives of unchastity and impurity and drunkenness and the other things. And he says, and then, you know, without going to confession, you just come up and receive Holy Communion. And he said, and that's a further sacrilege on top of all the other sins. That's another big sin, by receiving Holy Communion unworthily. And then he, you know, he said a few other things, and then he sat down. And then the Mass continued, and everybody was still like, what? What did we just see? So at communion time, Joan, I watched. I couldn't help it. Forgive me, Lord. There were, you know, a significant number of people who did not get up and go to Holy Communion. And so I interpreted that to mean that his words really hit home. I mean, he hit them right between the eyes, and he hit them hard. So the coda to that story, Gene, is, you know, I left the following morning. I got on my big old jet airliner, and I was thinking about what I had just seen. I had never seen anything like that. I had never heard of anything like that, of a Catholic priest saying or doing something like that. And I was thinking about that, and it really, like, wow, you know, that's amazing. Not, you know, I didn't quite know what to make of it, except that, you know, he really reached them, whether or not they were happy about it or not, I don't know, but he reached them. He got their attention. So about a month goes by, about a month goes by, and I'm back out west, and this time I'm in Reno, and I'm doing an event for like a Catholic professional business person's thing event. And there are, I don't know, 100, 150 people in the audience, and I'm giving my talk. And at a certain point in my talk, I don't know why this happened, Gene, but that the thing that had happened with the priest talking to the congregation a month earlier, it just came into my mind. And I thought, you know, that would be a really good point I could make here. And then as I'm talking, I'm thinking to myself, but I could never say that to these people. I could never say that. And then I thought, yeah, but I could say that the priest said that. So I said it. So I told the story, just as I told it to you now. And the same reaction, the people in the audience gasped, like, oh my gosh, I can't believe he said that. And so I just told the story just as I told you the story. And then I finished up my talk, and then I, you know, grabbed my briefcase or whatever, and I went back to my book table to sign some books. And this woman came up to me. I don't know how young she was. She might have been in her mid-30s maybe. And she came up to me, and I could see that she was upset, and she was kind of crying a little bit. And she said, I need some advice. What advice can you give me? Because, I feel like I really need to reconnect with my Catholic faith. And at first I wasn't sure what she meant. I mean, like, are you wanting to study the Bible more, or do you want to read up on church history? And I wasn't sure what she meant. And she said, that story that you told about what the priest said, she said, he was describing me. What? He was describing me. She said, I am doing most of those things and have been for a long time. And she says, I don't even remember how long ago it's been since I've gone to confession. And I'm doing many of those things. And I go to communion every Sunday. And she said, I finally realized that I am on my way to hell. She said it just like that, with tears in her eyes. And she says, what do you recommend? What can I do? So I pointed to the back of the room that we were in, and I said, there are a couple of priests back there who attended the talk. My advice, go over to one of them and tell them that you really need to go to confession, and I'm certain that Father will hear your confession here and now. You know, you can go out in the hallway, or you can go in some area that's not, you know, with other people, and I'm sure he'll hear your confession. So she thanked me, and she turned and she walked over to the priest, and, you know, they were far enough away that I couldn't hear what was said, but it was really clear. She asked him, Father, would you please hear my confession? And I saw him nod, and they turned and they walked out into the hallway, out into the lobby probably. And so for me, Gene, not only was that a high impact message that the priest gave to the people that day who were not expecting it, and probably many of whom were angered by it, but some of them, I'll bet, were saved by it. Even telling the story secondhand at a business person's meeting a month later, in even me just recounting the story, had a saving effect on this woman. And it just, I've never forgotten it. And that's the story.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. It's helping me tremendously. So thank you.
You're welcome, Gene. Thanks for bringing it up. I haven't told that story in ages. So there it is. 888-914-9149. Let's go. Cyrus, what would you do before we go to the next call? What would you do if you were in church and the priest said something like that? That would get your attention, right?
I would definitely stop daydreaming.
Oh, yes. I can only imagine maybe some of the nasty grams that were sent as a result of that.
Be nice.
No, I'm saying, I'm sure there were, how dare he tell me that I'm, you know, I'm not going to heaven. Anyway, let's go to, see, and I would never say that to anybody, but I can tell them that the priest said it.
That's right.
All right. John in Monterey, California. Welcome to the program.
A great story. You should tell it more often.
Thank you.
My question is concerning the church's standing on Lent and covering the statuary in the church.
Okay.
The church I'm in, they don't cover statuary, and I have tried to get them to do that, and it hasn't happened. And I would like to know when the other callers behind me, if they would kind of give a little poll of if their parish covers their statuary, because you get calls all over the country, so. I would just like to hear and get your understanding of church protocol on Lenten observance.
Got it. So this is the custom in the Latin Rite, and that is during Holy Week, the parishes will cover the statues and images with a purple cloth. And the custom is basically born out of wanting us to narrow our focus and think about what Jesus did for us in his passion and death. And so by way of covering these images, it's a way of removing distractions. Not that the saints are distractions, not that Our Lady is a distraction, but it's a way of forcing us, in a good way, to really narrow our focus on Jesus and to think about what he went through. So the purple corresponds with the purple robe that he was mocked with after the scourging at the pillar. They were told in the Gospels that they put a purple cloak on him. And that, of course, was redolent of royalty and redolent of royal power. And they did so as a way to mock Jesus, as they did with the crown of thorns. So the cloth is purple. It is the color of the season of Lent. And so that's the long and short of it. That's why it's done. Now, it's unfortunate that for whatever reason, the parish that you're attending, they don't follow the church's tradition on this. It's not a law. It's certainly not a doctrine. It's a custom. I don't think it has the force of law, but I do believe that it is proposed in the church's liturgical books. So the priest is probably aware that the church recommends doing this, but who knows why he's not doing it. I don't know. But that's why it's done. Does that make sense, Jerry? Maybe we lost Jerry. I hope that's helpful, Jerry. Thank you. We'll go now to Kate in Wisconsin. Hello, Kate.
Hi, Patrick. It's great to talk to you.
Thanks.
I just have a quick comment and then a question. So my first comment is, I'm a nurse, and you were talking about the vaccine mandate in Ireland for the nursing students. So it's very common for the flu shot to be mandated as well. Everywhere I've worked in several hospitals, they require the flu vaccine unless you have some compelling reason not to get it.
What would be, just before we go on, Kate, what would be a compelling reason that would be acceptable?
If you are allergic to it, and it would be, a high risk for you to get it for some reason.
Okay.
And the other reason I've seen is maybe religious.
Okay. So there are provisions for people who want to, conscientiously object. They allow for that?
Yes, but also, I think I've worked in one or two hospitals where they have said that if you can't get it or won't get it, that we have the right to terminate your employment.
Right.
So it depends on the state, I think, or the policy of the hospital.
Okay. And I don't, just for the record, I don't object to those kinds of protocols. It's not as though I see a hospital or a medical practice saying that if you're going to be dealing with patients, you have to have this or that. I don't object to that per se. I'm just saying that the COVID-19 vaccination, of course, and the virus itself is affecting everybody everywhere. So it's just interesting to see how it's being dealt with in Ireland.
Yeah,
for example.
I think the hospitals just really want to have a certain level of standard of care, and things can get out of control if the employees are infecting the patients.
Right.
So,
yeah,
I think that's,
it's in the military too. I mean, if you go in, as you know, if you go into any branch of the military, whether you want to or not, you're getting vaccinated, You're getting all the vaccinations, and that's how it's going to be. So
absolutely,
I get it.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that, I just want to make that comment just sort of to give some context to that. Those of us in the medical field are not shocked at all about that.
Right.
The other thing, I had seen an article about a Father Darius Oko who said that it needs to be made known that there is a homo heresy in the church, that basically people that want to become bishops and such have to have a certain devotion to the homosexual community. And I wanted your take on that.
Okay. I don't have time to give you my take on that at the moment because of the break, but when I come back, I'll offer a thought or two. Thank you, Kate. Happy Holy Thursday. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. Okay, so Kate asked me a question before we had to take our break, and she said she was referring to some priest, I'm not familiar with him, but that he said that there is a problem with homosexuality in the church, and she said something about how this is something that's required or in some way connected with being made a bishop. So the first thing I'll say is, not being a bishop myself, I'm a layperson. I'm not privy to whatever the, you know, the process that's involved. I have a general awareness of the process involved in determining, you know, if a priest is going to be consecrated as a bishop. And I had one opportunity to have it explained to me in Rome by the then secretary of the Congregation for Bishops at the time. It was Archbishop, my mind is going blank on me. He became the Archbishop of Philadelphia. And if you hadn't asked me, I could have told you his name, and now I can't remember. But I'll remember it, probably at 2 o'clock this morning. So over dinner one evening, he explained to me the process, and he said that this is it's time-consuming, and when a diocese is becoming open, there is a search underway for men who would be suitable to become the bishop, in the case of a diocesan bishop. Archbishop Regali, by the way, became Cardinal Regali. And there's what's called a terna, which is a list of three candidates that are kind of after the process takes place and the people and the clergy and, of course, the former bishop himself and the papal nuncio, etc. And they all weigh in and sort of sifted out and sifted out and sifted out. Eventually, it comes down to a terna of three names. And that terna is presented to the Pope. And the Pope can either say, I want this one, or he might, as Pope John Paul II often did, say, I don't want any of these guys. Find me some other possible candidates. And Cardinal Regali, or at that time Archbishop Regali, told me that that was not an uncommon scenario where Pope John Paul II would reject the three names that were presented to him and ask for other possibilities. So I have an understanding of the process itself, but I have no knowledge whatsoever about whatever other components might go into it at a human level. But I'm aware that there are allegations that this problem of sodomy within the clergy is a part of, in some instances, is a part of that. Now, all I can do is just tell you that I've heard this story before, but I have no knowledge of it. So the best I can tell you is this, that St. Peter Damian, back in the, what was it, the 12th century, the 11th century, I think it was, he wrote a book called the Book of Gomorrah. I believe it's Liber Gomorrensis in Latin, if I'm not mistaken. So in this book, it was a treatise on the evil of sodomy in the clergy. And apparently it was a at that time, it was a serious problem. There were many scandalous instances in the clergy. And so he wrote this book as a guide, a set of guides for the church on how to deal with the problem. And he was very stringent about this. And so the problem that he identified all those centuries ago was not unique to that time. Apparently it existed before that, and seems it has existed and even maybe flourished in some cases since then. So as an objective fact, we can say the church recognizes that whenever that issue appears, it's a serious problem. And therefore, it relies upon the prayers of the people and the virtue of the clergy to root it out and to do what they can to oppose it and to root it out to greater or lesser degrees of success. So this is not something new to our generation. It's been around a long time, as St. Peter Damian points out. And this book, by the way, is available in English online. You can easily Google it and read it for yourself. It's still in print. It's still being printed. So those are my comments. I mean, just I want to acknowledge that this is a reality in the church over a long period of time. And to the extent that it's real now and to the extent that it's a problem now, I believe that, just as St. Peter Damian said, it's something that has to be opposed and conquered, has to be opposed and overcome. And I'll have to leave it to the bishops and the Pope, because they're the ones who are in charge. And of course, God himself, our Lord, is the one who's the head of the church. So for you and for me, Kate, rather than become morose over this issue, I think the best thing to do is to say God alone knows the extent of it. And the best thing we can do is to pray, lead good, holy lives ourselves, show good example, pray for our bishops, and leave the rest in God's hands. So those are my thoughts. I hope that's helpful. We're going to go to Gavin now in California. Gavin, they tell me you're 7 years old. Welcome.
Hi, Mr. Madrid.
Hi, Gavin. Thanks for calling.
I have a question for you. Okay. Why did God create bugs?
I wish I knew. I wish God hadn't created mosquitoes and flies and certain spiders and scorpions. And for that matter, let's mention snakes and all kinds of other things that I wish God hadn't created. But he created them, this is the answer to your question, Gavin, because they all have a place in nature. And you probably already know how bigger animals will eat smaller animals for food. And so all these little creatures, all the bugs and the flies and the mosquitoes and the spiders and all that, they all have a place in nature. And they're food for other animals. And they also help to take care of smaller animals, smaller insects, for example, that would get out of control if they weren't eaten. So it's all a balance, and all these different creatures together kind of help keep things under control. But I honestly, Gavin, I do wish that there were some particular creatures that God didn't create, but he did. So what can we do? We have to accept them because God created them. What do you think? You're welcome, Gavin. And tell your mom thanks for letting you call me. Let's go to Tom now in San Diego. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, Patrick. How are you today?
Not too bad for a sinner, if you must know the truth.
Hi. Okay. Patrick, very quick question, please. Years and years ago, the nuns used to tell us about St. Dismas, who was crucified with Jesus, because he asked Jesus to remember him when he went to heaven. Mm-hmm. Well, according to Luke, to chapter 23, Jesus told him, yes, this day you will be with me in paradise. The question is, that same passage doesn't appear the same way in the other Gospels. Either the authors of the other Gospels say that they mocked Jesus or scorned him or didn't pay any attention to him, in direct contradiction to Luke chapter 23. Can you help me out on that, please?
Sure. The Matthean version, we find, let me just pull this up here. So we find the Matthean version in Matthew 27 and the Markan version in Mark chapter 15. Luke tells a story. This is the one you're referring to in Luke 23. And John tells a story in John 19. So there's no contradiction here, but only an apparent one. So in Matthew's gospel, in verse 38, it says, "Then there were two thieves crucified with him, one on the right hand and another on the left. And they that passed by reviled him, wagging their heads." And then in verse 44, it says, "The thieves also, which were crucified with him, cast the same in his teeth." And it's referring to the blasphemies. So it doesn't tell us, number one, if it was only two thieves. It would seem that there were two men who were certainly crucified immediately to the right and to the left of Jesus. But it's entirely possible that there were other men who were crucified there as well. So in the versions that talk about, that don't mention the good thief and only mention the two and maybe others who were also mocking Jesus, that's possible. And it may simply be that they didn't give any attention to the good man who actually did say what we know St. Dismas said to Jesus. Another dimension of this would be that it could be that he started off bad-mouthing Jesus, and then he came to his senses. And as he himself was nearing death, he repented of what he was formerly saying, and then he came to faith in Jesus and said what he said to Jesus. So that, too, would resolve any apparent contradiction. It just doesn't tell us in Matthew's and Mark's and Luke's version of the story that the good thief did that, but it would be completely in keeping with the story, even if he were negative toward Jesus at first and then decided to change and come to faith in Jesus. So that would obviate any potential contradiction. Does that make sense, or does that help?
Yes, it does. It does, and maybe it's the type of Bible that it's printed in.
No, I don't think it's that. It's not the type of Bible. It's the each of the different renditions of the story has different, they have different details. And you'll see this actually in other instances in the Gospels where the same story is told, but there are different details. And sometimes, unless you carefully compare them, it might look at first as though there's a contradiction. But really, as in this case, all that's happening is the detail of this one man at a certain point saying what he said to Jesus is omitted in the other stories. But what they say there doesn't mean that it couldn't have happened as it's told in Luke. So it's not your translation, it's not the version, it's just the way the story is told in that gospel. Anyway, Tom, thank you. It's a great question. And as we approach Good Friday tomorrow, of course, we'll be thinking about that in a particular way. On the road to glory, by the way, you know, we make a stop at Calvary, but then it's on to resurrection and victory. So that's what we're aiming for, but we have to go through Calvary to get to Easter Sunday, don't we? 888-914-9149 is the number to call. We have a line that just opened up. You can call now, 888-914-9149. We'll get you on the air with your question. If you want to send me a question by email, just go to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. You can send it to me there. And I'll look forward to talking with you on the other side of this quick timeout. Please stay right there.
I got a fever, and the only prescription is more Patrick Madrid. Come on.